you look at being black in America. Number one, people unfortunately are more likely to be of low socioeconomic status, which makes it harder to social distance. Number two, we know that blacks are more likely to have diabetes, heart disease, lung disease, and I've shared myself personally that I have high blood pressure, that I have heart disease and spent a week in the ICU due to a heart condition, that I actually have asthma and I'm pre-diabetic. And so I represent that legacy of growing up poor and black in America, and I and many black Americans are at higher risk for COVID. It's why we need everyone to do their part to slow the spread.
Surgeon General Jerome Adams confirming what early data is starting to show. African Americans are dying of the coronavirus at much higher rates than whites. In Louisiana, 70% of people who died of the coronavirus were black, despite being just 30% of the population. Here in LA, 17% of the people in the county who died were black, about double the population figure. Joining us to talk about how the coronavirus is impacting African Americans are Congresswoman Karen Bass. She represents parts of West and South LA. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back.
And Dr. Oliver T. Brooks. He's president of the National Medical Association and chief medical officer of the Watts Healthcare Corporation. Welcome to you, Dr. Brooks.
Happy to be here with you, Madeline.
Well, let's begin with you. I understand you felt early on that this was going to have a serious impact on African Americans. Why?
I know that we suffer disproportionately from underlying health conditions, comorbidities as they're called, diabetes, hypertension, and I will note hypertension is by the CDC's information found to be the number one comorbidity that leads to worse outcomes, morbid obesity, chronic kidney disease, asthma, etc. So just putting one and one together. I mean, we've known in the black community for decades and with the NMA that there are these disparities in comorbidities. And then when you layer that on top of the information coming out of the CDC that said that that was higher risk for death and hospitalization, it was just a matter of putting one and one together and noting that it was going to happen. And then it happened.
Right. All right. So they're the underlying health conditions. But what about also the fact that proportionately, many more blacks are on the front lines doing jobs that would maybe put them in contact with people who have the disease, such as working in hospitals, fast food, sanitation. Could that also be part of the reason?
Absolutely. So when you look at one of the major outcomes of health, there's something called social determinants of health, which most of you all know. And so we suffer from issues with social determinants of health. So, for example, we may have a low-income job where we can't be working from home, working on our computer, submitting documents. We may be the bus driver, we may be the food service worker. So we have to go out into the environment where everyone else is safer at home, sheltered in place. So we're more exposed. Mm-hmm. We may need to take public transportation to get to work. So we may have more exposure there. We may live in lower mod income housing. So there may be six or seven of us in a two-bedroom apartment. So that social distancing, the self-isolation, self-quarantine, much more difficult to access. We may have to travel farther to get food, more exposure. So all of these play directly into this particular disproportionate effect of African Americans by COVID-19 infection.
And yet you're not seeing the same rate with Latinos who may also be doing these jobs.
So I was just informed of that yesterday as I started seeing the data come out from the LA Times, and I cannot explain that. This is early data. This is data from one county, and as it's been stated in other arenas, we just don't have a lot of data. So it's too early. The numbers are low, and I think it's too early to speak to that.
Mm. Congresswoman Bass, what are you seeing with the data, in particular in LA County?
Well, not just in LA County, but nationally, the same thing, the disproportionate death rate. But really, what we have now, I would consider anecdotal data, because we do not have the official systematic data coming out of the Center for Disease Control. And it's actually curious, because it's not clear whether or not the Center for Disease Control was told not to collect racial data anymore, or if they were collecting it and not disseminating it. But we were trying to push a bill out of the House today. It failed over in the Senate, so we'll be back at it. But we included language in that bill that would require the CDC to not just gather the information, but to distribute it. So what we're hearing about is the death rate. But what about the infection rate? What is happening to black people along the way? Are they showing up sick and they're told to go home? Are their symptoms minimized by the time they go to the hospital? Are they severely sick and then they're put on a respirator and don't survive? So we need to know the entire picture. And that's something, you know, that will take a while. But even while we're in the midst of this crisis, the Congressional Black Caucus is calling for the collection and dissemination of the data, but we're also calling for focused and concentrated testing. We want to make sure where the death rate is high, that those medical centers have access to rapid testing, because that's the other issue, is people getting tested and not getting their results for 7 to 10 days, or maybe never getting their results. So there's a lot of areas of this that we have to address. We'll be preparing another larger package of bills, hopefully by the end of this month, and we want to make sure that we have provisions in the next bill that will specifically address this egregious health situation that we have.
Well, Congresswoman, you mentioned the bill that failed. I think a lot of people were counting, a lot of your constituents, a lot of Americans in general were counting on Congress getting another stimulus package through. What's the likelihood of that happening anytime soon, given the fact that Congress is on recess?
Well, oh, no, that doesn't matter. It's a very high likelihood that we will do this because, you know, the first three bills that we passed because we were in the beginning of a crisis. And in that sense, you kind of throw spaghetti on the wall, you run, you stick your finger in the dam because you know it's going to break. And then you pass these bills. But now we have to find out what works and didn't work in what we passed. So, for example, we passed hundreds of billions of dollars for small businesses. Well, our small businesses aren't able to get that money. Why? So we have to go back and fix that. The checks that people are supposed to get are a little bit delayed because the IRS was overwhelmed. The unemployment insurance that we extended, the unemployment offices around the country have been absolutely overwhelmed. So we've provided things for people in the community, but it's going to take a while to get there. I have absolutely no doubt that we will have additional bills. I do believe that they will be sooner than later because this is an unbelievable situation. You have a public health crisis and an economic catastrophe at the same time. So I know that we will act. And fortunately, we have leaders like Speaker Pelosi, because if anything passes, it will pass because it was started in the House.
Dr. Brooks, from your perspective as a physician, as someone involved in the medical community and watching this unfold in your practice and in a larger scope, what do you want from our elected officials?
So the Congresswoman spoke to one aspect of it, and that is access to those small business loans. Congresswoman Bass, Speaker Pelosi, and others are looking to get another bill coming through where the small businesses in our community, including healthcare, will have access to funds. That is crucially important. The money coming through, the $1,200, that'll be helpful to our employees at my health center, be helpful to our patient population, and also the unemployment. So those numbers of people in healthcare and FQHCs across the country, hundreds of thousands may be found to be unemployed because right now in healthcare, our visits are way down. We are not doing any elective procedures. A lot of our preventive care has been postponed. So right now, all the focus is on COVID-19. So right now, a lot of the solo and small practices are suffering greatly. So there's the healthcare crisis, but I am really happy that it is being spoken to, that there is an economic crisis, again, that affects black people, including black doctors, disproportionately.
Right. I want you to address this rumor that was spread, I think, amongst African Americans that really was quite damaging, that they were potentially immune to this disease. How big effect did that have on what you're seeing on your patients, Dr. Brooks?
I would say that it did not have as large of an effect as it might be perceived. In other words, the real effect is these are the things that of which we speak. There was some anecdotal, some statement, a rumor about having melanin and not being susceptible, or those in Africa weren't getting it. I think, first of all, it is present in Africa, and you might not have seen a lot of it because they weren't doing a lot of testing. So it had some effect, but the message that I put out is that unlike some other aspects of our society, this virus does not discriminate. It'll hit you just like it'll hit anyone else, and for African Americans, it'll likely hit you harder.
There is always systematic, or I shouldn't say always, over the last few years, systematic disinformation campaigns targeting the African American population. So when we're past this crisis, we need to look back and see, because I wouldn't be surprised if some of the same people promoting these beliefs are also the same people who are telling us not to vote. Some of it I know was playful and kind of got out of hand, but I also think there's other forces at work here.
All right, we'll have to end it there. I want to thank you both very much for joining us today. Congresswoman Karen Bass, who represents parts of West and South LA, and Dr. Oliver T. Brooks, president of the National Medical Association. Thank you both so much.
Thanks for having us on.
Thank you for having me on the show.
We're all supposed to be wearing masks in public now. Well, that's easier for some people than others. For Black men, wearing a mask can be problematic. A tweet by an Ohio man named Aaron Thomas went viral this week. He said he wouldn't wear anything that isn't clearly a protective mask. He said, quote, "Because I am a Black man living in this world, I want to stay alive, but I also want to stay alive." He spoke yesterday to NPR's Here and Now.
There's literally no way that I felt comfortable and or safe walking into a convenience store, a grocery store, a pharmacy with a bandana or something else like a scarf covering my face. Right. You know, Black folks and community of colors are hyper aware of the danger that awaits us every time we leave the house.
Well, to talk about that, we have Jody Armour with us now, a law professor at USC. Welcome back to Press Play, Jody.
Great to be back with you, Madeline.
Well, what do you hear when you hear what Aaron just said?
Yeah, well, I hear his experience echoing that of my own and many of the people I know, the dilemma that's really facing Black folk who are thinking about wearing bandanas and other makeshift masks to reduce the risk of not only contracting COVID-19 ourselves, but to show care and concern for the health and well-being of others around us by wearing masks that protect them as well. Here's the dilemma we seem to confront. Do I decrease my risk of contracting COVID-19 and decrease my risk of spreading that infection to others around me? And to do that, I must increase my risk of being mistaken for a dangerous criminal. So, you know, it's kind of a pick your poison situation, Madeline. You know, you decrease your risk of contracting COVID-19 and of spreading it to others by wearing masks that increase your risk of being mistaken for a dangerous criminal and possibly either getting gunned down or perhaps even thrown in jail and packed with others who are potentially infected people and worsening your plight that way.
Yeah. Well, does it matter what kind of mask? Like if you wear a bandana, that may be a little bit more risky than if you're wearing a surgical mask?
Yeah, well, the homemade makeshift mask, the bandanas, are more often associated with those sketches you see or the grainy footage from cameras in stores that often show a mask assailant, and too often disproportionately they're also an assailant of color, and so that might trigger certain stereotypes in people's minds. But even if I'm wearing a surgical mask, you know, it still conceals my identity to a large extent, and for those who are suspicious, who are prone to being suspicious, especially of people of color, it might be six of one, half a dozen the other. There might be very little difference in practical effect between a homemade one and one that's more, you know, a standard issue.
And do you think that LA has a bigger problem with this because of the whole gang situation and the fact that there are colors associated with certain gangs and that the police have issued guidance for how gangs are identified, and there's also, you know, people can be arrested for associating with a gang member?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, this COVID crisis really exposes and aggravates a lot of underlying inequalities and disparities, and those, some of them may be connected to gang identification. We know that the elite metropolitan unit has had problems misidentifying a lot of citizens as gang members when they're not, simply because they have some trappings of gang members that are part of the popular culture costume these days. But, you know, this crisis exposes and aggravates a whole host of underlying inequalities. We know that people of color, for example, are contracting this infection at a higher rate than others, and poor people and homeless people and people with disabilities. So it should sadden but not surprise us that this particular crisis is aggravating a lot of those underlying disparities and inequalities.
But do you think that because everyone has to go out now with a mask, that that could change things and make it better, so maybe men of color, black men, Latino men, wouldn't be viewed as suspiciously if everybody's wearing a mask?
Well, you know, you would hope that, but, you know, we're talking about items of wear, gear that people wear, and even though, for example, hoodies are very popular, I see a lot of people of all races wearing hoodies all the time. Hoodies on a black man or a black woman, a black person, carry a different social meaning than a hoodie on a non-black person, just as we saw with Trayvon Martin. Rest in peace, Trayvon Martin. You have people like Geraldo Rivera saying that the reason Trayvon was shot down was because of the hoodie, rather than other kinds of factors. And you really have to wonder if Trayvon Martin was a 17-year-old Brad Pitt with a hoodie, if he would have been construed to be as big a danger as he was as a black boy of 17 with the hoodie. So I'm not so sure that the ubiquity of the masks will actually override the unconscious and conscious biases that trigger and fuel racial profiling.
So what are you going to do, and what would you recommend other black men to do?
Yeah, well, you want to be civic-minded. You want to look out for your neighbors and not expose them to infections by wearing masks, and you want to protect yourself. You want to get home alive on the one hand, and on the other hand, you want to get home alive. You know, you also don't want to be mistaken for an assailant. So you really are on the horns of a dilemma, and it's just kind of the blues. I call it, you know, the black tax blues. You know you're going to have to pay this tax, and you're just going to have to. I tell my sons all the time, you know, part of being a black person in America, a black man in America, because I have three boys, I happen to, is, you know, you know that you have the blood of a slave, but you have to have the heart of a lion. You have to have the heart of a lion to go out here into the public place knowing that people are going to have stereotypes about you that expose you to threats, and live your life anyway. You know, we're talking about a public health crisis on the one hand, but, you know, stereotypes are a public health crisis too for black folk. So we're caught on the horns of two different kinds of public health crises, and there's really no good solution. That's why it's a dilemma.
Jody, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Madam.
Stay safe out there. Jody Armour is a law professor at USC. Coming up, men are being hospitalized and dying at greater rates than women, and it's not because of lifestyle factors. We'll talk with a doctor who says the double X chromosome offers more protection against COVID-19. That's next on Press Play.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, we just heard coronavirus has had a disproportionate impact on African Americans. New demographic data published by the CDC shows another group may face an increased risk, and that's men. Preliminary data show men are more likely to be hospitalized and more likely to die than women. China and Italy saw the same thing. Men are more likely to smoke, but they also may have a genetic disadvantage when it comes to fighting a virus. That's according to Dr. Sharon Mualim, author of the new book, The Better Half, on the genetic superiority of women. And he joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So the numbers by the CDC suggest that men are more at risk. And in places like New York City, we're already seeing that those numbers look even worse for men. Preliminary data show that men in New York were twice as likely to die as women. Do these numbers surprise you, given your research, or no?
Unfortunately, not at all. I mean, when I wrote the book, I made a prediction that the next major pandemic that humanity would face, more men would unfortunately succumb. And I never imagined or even hoped, of course, that would happen in my lifetime. But unfortunately, it's happening right in front of us. And as you can see, now it's about 37 countries that we have sex disaggregated data where we can figure out, exactly how men and males and females are doing. In every one of those countries, men are outdying women at about that rate of 2 to 1. And so this is holding true, regardless of country, culture, and also behaviors. So you mentioned smoking, which was interesting. The first thing that people tend to fall back on is behavior. And unfortunately, sometimes it's blaming the victim here. Initially, that made sense. 60% of men in China smoke, about 1 to 2% of women smoke. But as other countries, the data started coming in, and the difference between smoking between men and women is just a few percentage points. For example, in the U.S., 15% of men smoke and about 13 or 14% of women smoke. So all the behavioral explanations started falling apart. But what we're witnessing and experiencing in front of us is really just the female survival advantage, and it all comes back down to our sex chromosomes. And so females inherit two X's, one from their mother, one from their father. Males have only one. And this provides an immense advantage to females because many of the genes that are involved in immunological defense, fighting new emerging viruses, just like COVID-19, those genes are on the X chromosome. So women naturally are more genetically diverse. They have all these other genes that they can call on to fight infections, and men only have this one X chromosome. So if they don't have a gene that's very good at recognizing COVID-19 or killing the virus, they're going to be at a disadvantage. And we're seeing in every one of these countries the results of that.
Okay, so what is it about the double X chromosome? What is it about the extra X that could be protective for women? Why is that the thing that could conceivably prevent women from dying at the same rates as men from this virus?
The first answer, that the X is a very large chromosome, has about 1,000 genes on it, compared to the Y that only has 70. So women, by having an extra X to use, women have an extra 1,000 genes at their disposal. And many of these genes are crucial for immune function. So I'll just play out an example for you. In a woman, in her immune cells, some of the cells might be using the X from the father, the other might be using X from their mother, and they'll use this in tandem and cooperate. So maybe that one immune cell using the X from the father is very good at recognizing viruses like COVID-19, but not really good at killing them. And then the other immune cell that's using the other X is not so good at recognizing them, but very good at killing any invading viruses. And so they end up working together. One recognizes and the other does the killing.
And what other health advantages do women have because they have two X chromosomes?
Pretty much every health advantage that leads to survival and longevity. Women get a lot less cancers than men. The numbers for the U.S. Currently, men get 150,000 extra cases of cancer every year compared to women. This runs the gamut of surviving or even preventing cancer from forming, or surviving an infection, and even surviving any type of physical hardship such as famine.
So there must be some bad news associated with this. Is there something that women actually have a worse time off with because they have two X's?
There is. I mean, nothing's ever free in biology. And
yeah.
So the advantage of having a very aggressive immune system, female immune cells are very aggressive and immunologically violent. It also doesn't take a lot to get them off the immunological couch. unlike male cells that tend to be very lazy. And so that immunological aggressiveness is sometimes directed towards their own bodies, the result of which is an autoimmune disease. And so when it comes to autoimmunity, conditions like multiple sclerosis, lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, autoimmune thyroiditis, the list is endless. Almost every single autoimmune disease that we know of, save except very small exceptions, happen to women. And we're talking about the rate. If it's lupus, it could be 9 women to every 1 man.
So when it comes to initial infection, how does COVID-19 get into the body, and is it different for men and women?
That's such a great question. So COVID-19, to get into the body, uses a spike protein, and this spike protein is like a key. And it has to unlock something called ACE2, which is a lock on all our cells. And so that the gene for ACE2 is on the X chromosome. So that means that all of my cells have the same locks. So if COVID-19 has a perfectly fitting key to my lock, it'll be able to unlock all of my cells and get in, and then I'm in trouble. And yet, if it tries to unlock women's cells, women have 2 different types of locks, because the lock is coded on the X chromosome. So to get in and invade all of a woman's lung cells, that key would have to actually pick 2 locks. So the chances of that happening are a lot.
So let me get this straight. Women and men can be infected at the same rate, but the infection severity can differ between men and women. Men would be much more severely impacted, require hospitalization, and eventually, unfortunately, die. They're more likely to do all of that than women.
That's correct. And it all comes back down to the fact that men only have 1 lock to prevent the virus from coming in, and women have 2.
Dr. Sharon Mualim, he's author of the new book, The Better Half, on the genetic superiority of women. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
President Trump has spent the last few weeks blaming governors and other local officials for the shortfalls in medical supplies they've been experiencing.
Governors are supposed to be doing a lot of this work, and they are doing a lot of this work. The federal government's not supposed to be out there buying vast amounts of items and then shipping. You know, we're not a shipping clerk.
That was on March 19th. Well, since then, he has softened that message, but he's still portraying the federal government as merely a backstop.
We're working hard with the governors. There's been great coordination, especially over the last little while. We're giving them a lot of equipment, a lot of ventilators, but a lot of equipment of all types. And I will protect you if your governor fails. If you have a governor that's failing, we're going to protect you.
Well, behind the scenes, the federal government has been seizing orders for medical supplies from some hospitals, and it's left them scrambling to try to get the supplies they need to face this pandemic. Noam Levy broke this story. He's national healthcare reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. Well, explain what's happening. Hospitals are complaining that they'll put in an order for, let's say, some gloves or masks, and then the government comes in and takes that?
That's essentially what a lot of the medical providers that I'm talking to are saying. Yes, they place an order, and the order is either expropriated after it has been placed, or in some instances, the federal government sweeps in and buys the equipment that the hospital was seeking to get. And I think the thing that many of the medical leaders I'm talking to find sort of most disturbing is that these expropriations are being made in many cases without any explanation whatsoever. So Hospital X orders, as you suggested, an order of N95 masks. They disappear, and the question is, where have they gone? Is the federal government taking them and redistributing them to New York City, say, or are they going into some stockpile? Are they going to a federal agency? Nobody seems to be able to provide any answers.
How do they disappear? Do they disappear where? At the docks or at the hospitals? Like, how does the government get this stuff?
I mean, I was communicating with somebody who said literally federal officials showed up at the loading docks of a trucking company that was delivering this stuff. And the person I was communicating with said he had no idea how they knew where this shipment was and where it could be taken. I think in other cases, the orders are being intercepted. I have heard at ports of entry as well. And I think, as I said, in other cases, the distributors are being directed to send the equipment to the federal government rather than to the medical providers who ordered it.
Wow. I mean, it all sounds like a mafia heist. It sounds so bizarre.
Yeah, I think it certainly has a little bit of that quality. Now, one presumes that the federal government is moving this equipment from parts of the country that have thus far not been put under strain yet by the coronavirus, and moving it to places like, say, New York City, where the hospitals are overwhelmed. But as I said, there's been a really disturbing lack of transparency about how this is happening, how decisions are being made about which materiel to be taken, and then, as I said, where that is going. As one hospital official I spoke to said, I hope this is going to New York. They certainly need it, but it would be nice to know that's, in fact, what the federal government is doing.
And then I suppose no promise that they'll get any of this material back when they need it.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's the other part of this. I mean, we've learned that the Strategic National Stockpile has effectively been depleted over the last few weeks, so there isn't any backstop left there. Now, it's possible that some of the material that the federal government is now appropriating from the existing supply chains will restock that. But again, there's just a widespread lack of confidence that this administration either has the skills to distribute this material in an effective and equitable way, or that the system is in place to assure that this is all being done on the up and up. I mean, we've seen the federal government badly mismanage the rollout and development of testing for coronavirus. So needless to say, confidence is not high in the medical community around the country.
And the legal authority they have is what, under the Defense Production Act?
That's right. So the Defense Production Act, which has gotten a lot of attention in the context of the president's direction to auto manufacturers to make ventilators, is sort of commonly seen as a tool for the government to actually order production, as the name of the statute would indicate. But there is a second authority in that law, which gives the federal government the authority in national emergencies to essentially go to the front of the line of pending contracts between private parties. But there's always an expectation that, this will be done in some orderly fashion, and without transparency, of course, there's no guarantee that that's the fact.
And does this only affect private hospitals, or can it also affect states?
It can be both.
Well, we just heard that Governor Newsom has placed an order for 200 million N95s for California. Could the federal government swoop in and take those?
I believe it could. I mean, I'm not an expert on all facts of the statute, but I believe that the authority would allow the federal government to swoop in under any circumstance and intervene in a contract. And I don't know whether the state of California has made any arrangements with FEMA or other federal agencies to prevent that. We'll see.
But this all seems to illustrate what Governor Cuomo had been complaining about, and that is that the states are basically bidding against each other for these supplies, and then also against the federal government, which has a much greater purchasing power than any of the states.
That's right. I think one of the things that that folks who are sort of out there trying to get equipment are most disturbed about is, in a best-case scenario, it might make a certain amount of sense for the federal government to, in fact, step in, to use its leverage and to essentially take over the entire supply chain. But in the clip you played earlier, President Trump has sort of indicated that he doesn't want to do that. And so the message that went out to hospitals and to states was, you're on your own, go and do it. Nobody was particularly happy about that message, but once that message was communicated, states and medical centers and clinics and everybody else sort of went about making the adjustments necessary to try to get that equipment. And sort of now they feel like, okay, we're doing this, but now the federal government is in fact coming in, but it seems to be done in a somewhat arbitrary way. It's sort of the worst of both worlds from the perspective of, of those on the ground who are trying to get the equipment that they need.
Noam Levy is national healthcare reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you so much.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Happy Passover! Coming up, we'll learn how to make matzo ball soup with Evan Kleiman.
I love adding a little bit of nutmeg. I got that from a gourmet recipe when I was like 10, and my mother tormented me about it my entire life.
Cooking with Evan, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's time for our weekly check-in with Evan Kleiman, host of KCRW's Good Food. Today, we're catching her just as she's making matzo balls for Passover. Hi.
Hi.
Happy Passover.
Happy Passover. I am multitasking, as we say.
You are. Okay, well, that's good because I want to know how to make matzo balls and I want to know how to make a really good chicken broth because they go together. So let's begin with the chicken broth.
So chicken broth is the easiest thing. You can build on it or you can open a can. What can I tell you? But my standard way is I like using a whole chicken. And if I have access to backs or necks or, for example, a rotisserie chicken carcass that might be in the fridge, I will throw that in too for more flavor. And first I cover it with water, I bring it to the boil, and then I skim off all the stuff that comes to the top so I can keep the broth as clean and clear as possible. Then I will cut an onion that a yellow onion that still has the peel on in half. I will throw that in. Leaving the peel on gives you some beautiful color to the broth without having to resort to adding turmeric, which a lot of people do. I love carrots and celery. If you have a parsnip, that to me makes it taste like Jewish chicken broth.
Do you put parsley in it?
If I have parsley, I put it in. But the parsnip kind of tastes like parsley on steroids. But yeah, you can definitely put parsley. And then the trick really, if there is a trick, is to just keep it at a simmer for a long time. If you want to eat the chicken, then you might want to take the chicken out after about, 40 minutes, an hour definitely. And then if you feel your broth needs to have more concentrated flavor, you can just reduce it. So you don't want to add salt until the end of cooking.
When you take the chicken out and you want to maybe shred the meat and put it back in
exactly.
The soup, how does that change the flavor of the broth? Because you're taking out the whole chicken, right? And so then what are you simmering?
Personally, full disclosure, I really love boiled chicken because I grew up, making chicken soup, and I like kind of overcooked boiled chicken. So I leave the chicken in till the very end, till the broth is where I want it to be, which is a couple of hours. But for some people who would prefer to have their chicken to be more alive, you could take the chicken out earlier, not all of it. You can leave some of the carcass will just fall apart if you touch it. So you can remove the breasts and leave the rest of the chicken in there. And then you could cut up the breast meat and put that in your soup when you present it to the table.
Okay, so you take everything out, you strain it, and you have this lovely golden broth, hopefully. Then what do you do?
Well, you check it for salt, because without salt, forget it. Then you set it on the side. Actually, what I did when I made my soup is I knew I didn't have any access to schmaltz, to chicken fat to cook with, to put in my matzo balls. So I made sure to make my soup a day ahead and put it in the fridge so the fat came to the surface. And I used some of that fat instead of just oil in my matzo ball recipe, which, full disclosure, this year was not a recipe, but it was the delightful Miri of Miri's List brought me, like 3 weeks ago, she brought me a box of matzo ball mix, which I have never used before. So I just made them, and it's fine. It's just smashed up matzo meal. So like all matzo ball recipes, you start with beating your eggs, putting in the oil or the schmaltz, beat that together. Then you add the meal in and you stir it around. You want to make sure that that has a nice amount of salt and pepper. I love adding a little bit of nutmeg. I got that from a gourmet recipe when I was like 10, and my mother tormented me about it my entire life.
Why? She didn't think it was kosher.
The fact that I was making matzo balls from Gourmet Magazine, everybody thought was absolutely hilarious. But what I was left with was this idea of nutmeg in the matzo balls, which just a little bit, it's wonderful, that lovely warming fragrance. And then to cook your matzo balls, the most important thing that I learned from Adam Perry Lang a couple of years ago was that you have to keep the lid on your pan really tightly. And what basically happens is it also, each matzo ball almost becomes its own pressure cooker. And that's what keeps them super fluffy. That, and also not compacting them too much. Like when you have that batter in your hand, there's this tendency to just roll it up. You want to roll it up in a really pretty ball. But the more you compact it, the more likely you are to have a sinker rather than a floater.
And you're boiling them.
And you boil them. Then you put them in boiling water, and they're dumplings. So they will, if you put in a walnut size ball of matzo ball mixture, it will become close to a tennis ball. So
wow.
It really absorbs a lot. And this is why most people don't make it in soup. You make it in water, because you would need to have so much chicken broth to be able to allow so much of it to get absorbed into that ball.
What is the perfect size for a matzo ball?
Well, it depends on what your presentation is like and how many people. You know, I used to think that bigger was better if you were feeding a ton of people, because then you just had to put one ball in the soup. But when I used to have Passover at home, I used to make them small because I liked them to be more like a dumpling. Mm-hmm. So I used to put three in every bowl. So I think it's whatever size you want it to be. And usually if you have people helping you, there is a variety of sizes.
Yeah, variety of size hands making variety size matzo balls. Well, I guess this year,
exactly,
there's not going to be a big, huge table, big, huge gathering of people around the table. So you can do whatever you want with your matzo balls.
Yes, in my case, there will be one. And, you know, a half if you count Paco.
Paco the dog. Who I heard nuzzling a little bit. He's like making little Paco noises.
Yes, he feels that he should be allowed into this home studio situation.
All right, Evan, thank you. Happy Passover. And thank you for your recipe.
Thank you so much, Madeline.
That's Evan Kleiman. She's host of KCRW's Good Food. Coming up, when your best friend is an animated bunny, how the video game Animal Crossing has become a social lifeline in quarantine. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, if you like to play video games, staying home might not be so difficult. One game was released at the perfect time at the end of March as shelter-in-place orders just began to ramp up. And it has become a stay-at-home sensation. I'm talking about Animal Crossing New Horizons. That's the theme song. The game is kind of like Farmville or The Sims, except you're building your own island village. You're trading fruit for money, talking to kind strangers, bearing gifts. Joining me to talk about this is Kyle Buchanan. He wrote about the game for the New York Times. Hi, Kyle.
Hi, Madeline. Even hearing that theme song, it evoked a Pavlovian response in me. I was like, I got to scour my island for shells and start talking to my villagers.
Okay, so you're deep into this.
I am. You know, I'm sort of an off and on video gamer as I got older and ostensibly more adult. I think I looked for sort of more bite-sized games just because I was too busy to play anything that was more intense than that. And Animal Crossing is a franchise that's been around for about 20 years. They release a new game every several years. And I just hadn't paid attention to it before because I know that it's the sort of game, like you said, like The Sims, that's sort of a commitment. In fact, it runs on a real-time clock. So if you check into your island at 2 p.m., well, it's 2 p.m. on the island. If you check in at night, some of the villagers will be asleep, but maybe there will be rare bugs or fish. And I just thought, I don't have time for that. Well, now in quarantine, I've got time.
You have all the time in the world.
And it gives me sort of the illusion or the sort of digital simulation of forward momentum that I do not have in my real life at the moment.
Right. So just describe it for people who haven't delved into this. What does it look like? How do you create your island? By the way, what did you name your island?
I named my island Akbar. I named it after, because I downloaded this game on a Friday night. And usually on a Friday night, I would go meet my friends at this Silver Lake bar called Akbar and have some drinking and dancing. And since I wasn't able to do that, I thought it would be kind of a nice substitute. And it has been. In fact, my friends have come over to Akbar using their online connection. And obviously, it's a little less rambunctious than the real thing. But it's, you know, it's something, and something's better than nothing. But as far as how the game works, it's this kind of cartoonish, innocent but witty, Pixar-y kind of Nintendo game where you get flown to an island, you start building your house, you start renovating the island, and you attract other villagers to that island. As far as, you know, sort of the goals that most video games have, where you're supposed to save the princess or the world, there's nothing really like that here. In fact, your day inside the game is basically whatever you make of it. You can try to make some money by selling some fish, or you can just want, you know, gossip, walk around with your new island friends and see what's going on with them. There's all sorts of things that you can do and all sorts of ways you can customize the island. So it becomes kind of a fun thing to visit your friends' islands and see how they've built their thing up.
Oh, do you ever get island envy?
You absolutely do. I went over to a friend's house who was far wealthier in the game than I was, and he had the most sort of expensive items, things that I didn't even know you could get. It's kind of an interesting thing because, you know, at this point, I'm not having visitors over to my real life house. Like, my clothes are just sort of slung onto couches or chairs. But on my digital house, you know, I every time somebody comes over online, I'm like, oh, I got to make sure it looks really good. I want to put some cute stuff up on the walls and maybe buy some wallpaper and see what they think of it. It's kind of, even though there is a little bit of sort of digital keeping up with the Joneses at play with that dynamic, it's kind of fun just to have people over and to feel sort of twinge of excitement that somebody is visiting.
Do some people come over unannounced? Because I wouldn't like that.
You can open up your gates to people or you can keep them closed. So if you're a home buddy in real life, you can be a home buddy on the island too.
So is there kind of a, I don't know, a way to win, a way to get all the fruit and be the top dog on the island?
There are some sort of extremely mild lackadaisical goals. Basically, the more money you make, the more you can expand your house. And there are other things that you can do on the island. You can renovate it and get sort of a better star rating if it looks nice, and doing so will attract different types of people to your island. But if you don't want to do those things, you don't have to. And it kind of, even though you're paying off a loan to make your house bigger and bigger, it's interest free. It is a fantasy at this time of economic unease to be able to just pay what you want when you want.
Wow. So this really is a fantasy island.
It really is a fantasy island. And, you know, it's kind of funny. I've noticed that my the photo app on my phone, instead of filling up with sort of real life memories, which I would have if I were able to go out and see people and do anything, it's filling up with screen captures of Animal Crossing, which I then send to friends and family as though I were out in the real world.
So that has become your real world in a way.
Well, it's become a fun substitute for my real world.
I don't know, Kyle. It sounds like you're crossing over a little bit.
When my parents call me and ask, what have you been up to today? I don't have anything to tell them. Nothing to tell them. I'm waiting on a grocery delivery window. I got up. I played with my dog. I went back to bed. Every day is exactly the same. But if any of my friends with Animal Crossing ask what I've been up to, I can say, one of the villagers gave me a bidet, you know? The days on Animal Crossing are far more eventful than what I'm dealing with in my real life. And I do think that right now, when you have sort of the crushing tonnage of headlines, and, you know, it can be very hard to take a necessary mental health break from everything that's going on in the world. And sometimes you have to, in order to be able to process what the next day is going to give you. Mm-hmm. And Animal Crossing is very good for that. It is an escape in almost every possible way. And I think right now we need those sort of escapes or those little bits of joy where we can find them.
How long do you think you're going to be hanging out in Akbar?
Well, Madeline, I know you'll love to hear this, but the thing about Animal Crossing is it's built to last like maybe over a year. There's events and things that happen throughout the year, depending on the day, depending on the month. So how long am I going to be going to virtual Akbar? Well, until I'm allowed to go to real life Akbar, and it's anybody's guess when that's going to be.
Okay, well, until you and I can meet at the real Akbar, do I toast you in the fake Akbar? How do we get together?
Yes, you can raise your glass. You can come over if you get a switch, and you can visit my island.
And see your bidet. That'll be exciting.
Yes, my prized possession, my bidet.
Kyle Buchanan, he writes the New York Times, where you can read his article about Animal Crossing. Thanks, Kyle.
Thank you.
And that's it for us today on Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.